Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Congressman resigns and tells tense tale of White House intimidation.
I'm sitting there showering, naked as a jaybird, and here comes Rahm Emanuel, not even with a towel wrapped around his tush, poking his finger in my chest, yelling at me because I wasn't going to vote for the president's budget. Do you know how awkward it is to have a political argument with a naked man?
Former Congressman Eric Massa played an extra in the Obama administration's health care reform picture. Guess what? He's bitter about the cutting room floor. Vote trading meets Hitchcock. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 9th. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, joins me today in for Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Todd. Don't you love that Massa story?
Good morning, John. Yeah, I don't know what's going down the drain as Congressman Massa pulls down the shower curtain, whether it's blood or his political career.
All right,
One of the two.
That's not the top story this morning, but what is?
Let's get to some of those top stories, John. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says NATO and Afghan troops have seized momentum, but hard days lie ahead.
Of course, the operation in Marja is only one of many battles to come in a much longer campaign focused on protecting the people of Afghanistan.
Gates is visiting Kandahar today, which could be the site of the next big battle.
For more on Afghanistan, we were joined earlier by Chris Morris in Kabul. He's with our partner, the BBC. And I asked Chris if there are any decent metaphors for what's going on in Kandahar as coalition forces prepare for battle with the Taliban in the coming months.
Kandahar is the symbolic heartland of the Taliban. So by going into Taliban, McChrystal and other commanders here are sending the message, we're going to go after you right in the place where you believe you are strongest. The problem with that, of course, is that there will be casualties, foreign forces, probably civilians as well. I think that's inevitable. And Kandahar will possibly be the toughest moment of this expanded campaign over the next 12 to 18 months or so, when the aim of NATO is to clear a huge swathe of territory which has been Taliban controlled for a long time, and then quickly put in functioning civilian government behind it.
More of our discussion with Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan, in just a few minutes. Todd?
Here at home, President Obama headed into battle yesterday on health care. During a stop in Philadelphia, he tried to stiffen the spine of wavering Democrats and rally public support while sharpening his attack against Republicans.
I got all my Republican colleagues out there saying, well, no. We want to focus on things like cost. You had 10 years. What happened? What were you doing?
Now, the president wants the House to have a vote on the Senate's health care bill within the next 10 days. Back in Washington, there's a test vote in the Senate today that's important to anyone getting unemployment benefits. Democrats need at least one Republican to cross over to extend unemployment insurance and several popular tax breaks, which expired last year. And in Jerusalem this morning, Vice President Joe Biden called American ties to Israel unshakable. He met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to try to kickstart preliminary peace talks. He'll meet with Palestinian president tomorrow. And here at home, today is the first day of same-sex couple marriage in Washington, D.C. About 150 couples are expected to pick up their marriage licenses this morning. The District of Columbia joins five states in permitting same-sex unions.
Well, the caterers down there in D.C. will be getting calls, that's for sure. Asian markets now, they're mixed. European indices are down at this hour. Futures for Wall Street trading are also down. The Dow will get underway at 10,552. The S&P opens at 1,138, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Coming up, more men being laid off than women in the current recession. More mothers are becoming the family breadwinner. We're going to talk about how this is affecting the workplace and how employers deal with their employees later on in the hour. Our week-long series on genius continues today. You can catch up on our website, thetakeaway.org. We want to make today's question a little more personal. If you could be a genius at one thing, what would it be? Tell us about it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Come on, all you Stephen Hawkings, give us a call. Coming up, we turn to Afghanistan, where Allied forces are setting their sights on Kandahar. What's the strategy going forward? We'll talk in just a few minutes. Good morning, everyone. I'm here in New York. Todd Zwillick is joining me from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
So the big news this morning really is, you might say, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is behind enemy lines in Kandahar, southern Afghanistan, the Taliban stronghold. He's there today along with General Stanley McChrystal. On Monday, McChrystal said allied forces have seen success finally in the former Taliban stronghold of Marja.
We have essentially got control of the area now.
McChrystal says the U.S. now has its sights set on Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, and the one which makes Marja look something like a rural hamlet. Here's McChrystal again.
There won't be a D-Day that is climactic. It will be a rising tide of security as it comes.
And it's going to take some time to come. Both McChrystal and Gates in Kandahar are in anticipation of this much larger offensive in southern Afghanistan. And to get more on this, we went to Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul.
Yeah, this is something which we believe will happen later this year. It's always been the case that we started off with this Operation Mushtarak in and around Marja in Helmand province, but there is a broad swathe of territory in Helmand and then across the provincial border into Kandahar, where the Taliban have traditionally been in control. And it's that huge swathe of territory that NATO wants to take over and then get civilian government functioning. And one of the most symbolic places, probably the most symbolic place in that whole region, is the area in and around Kandahar city. I mean, there's a big NATO base in Kandahar, but the area around is very much the preserve of the Taliban. And that's something General McChrystal has identified as something he wants to change.
Now, I suspect this just completed campaign in Marja, one of its goals would have been to demonstrate to the Taliban that even on a small scale of territory in Helmand province, in Marja, that the Taliban can be removed. Is that message likely to go down well in Kandahar, to have any credibility in Kandahar, a much stronger stronghold of the Taliban, a much bigger place territorially?
That is one of the problems, is that whichever way you look at it, military operations, whether they're by foreign forces or Afghan, are not popular with local people. And you can understand it. It brings enormous disruption and danger. I was down in Marja a few days ago, and there were many, many complaints about military operations, even though NATO commanders insisted and some local elders agreed that troops had tried to be extremely careful about how they carried out those operations. It's a policy they're calling courageous restraint. Now, if you transfer those concerns from a relatively small place like Marja onto a big bustling city and surrounding districts like Kandahar, then those issues and those dangers will be magnified. So I think it's going to be a huge task. That's one of the reasons why Secretary Gates had said there are going to be some very tough days ahead, and it's way too soon to be talking about turning a corner in southern Afghanistan.
Well, then in your view, Chris Morris, is it starting from square one to go from Marja to Kandahar, or maybe a little bit ahead of that?
Well, you know, what's happening at the moment is that American troops, the surge, President Obama's surge, those troops are still arriving in country. We reckon about 6,000 have arrived at the moment. By the end of the summer, perhaps they'll be that's when the full 30,000 extra troops should have arrived. And many of those troops would be needed, I think, if there were to be a major operation about Kandahar, because it will be much bigger in scale and much bigger in the challenges it represents as well. And so I think Kandahar is probably the icing on the cake in terms of the way that McChrystal is planning this operation across these two provinces. But it's also clear that that's a place where there will be casualties. Already this year, American and British casualties and other NATO troops are far higher than they were at this time last year in terms of the number of people killed so far in the calendar year. And sadly, I think we do have to be prepared for the fact that that's going to continue throughout this summer. It's going to be a difficult summer with a lot of fighting. And the way they're doing the fighting means that NATO troops, foreign forces, will be taking casualties.
It was Chris Morris, BBC correspondent in Kabul. Let's bring in Colonel David Lam, who was the chief of staff in the Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2005. Colonel Lam, good morning.
Good morning, John.
You know, I want to give you the same question I gave to Chris Morris, and I don't know if he really answered it. Is the Marja offensive something that, while it ground out territory, and that's something they're going to have to do in Kandahar as well, ultimately the effectiveness of this entire surge is going to be convincing the Taliban that it's hopeless to resist? Do you think they made any headway on that in Marja?
Well, as the Secretary said, and I would probably add to his remarks, they have cleared militarily, and militarily they hold right now the town of Marja, a town of about 50,000 or so folks. The real test is whether the Afghan government can roll in behind, and with the police and with the Afghan army and police, they can now hold and, in fact, bring good governance to Marja. That would be the key. The key is...
So let me just hold you up there. So if there's good governance in Marja, the people in Kandahar will get that message, and all of a sudden that changes the military equation for the troops going forward in the next couple of months.
Well, perhaps, but as was pointed out earlier in the spot here, Kandahar is a completely separate and to draw lessons learned about Marja to Kandahar. Marja's 50,000 folks, rather small hamlet, as was pointed out. Kandahar is a major city of 850,000 people, and it is in fact the holiest of places. It is really the spiritual heart of the Taliban inside Afghanistan.
Can the government project itself as being a custodian of the holy lands of Afghanistan, or is that something that the Taliban owns at this point?
Well, it can over time, but I would say at the present time, the Taliban owns that mantra and has owned it since 1994,
right.
When Mullah Omar, in fact, the holiest site inside Kandahar is in fact a mosque which contains a cloak of the Prophet Muhammad. Last seen in 1994 when Mullah Omar actually put it on, a brilliant propaganda move that really wedded the Taliban as the religious keeper inside of Afghanistan.
Well, so again, it's a significant move that Secretary Gates is actually in Kandahar at this moment, setting up for what could be a reversal for the Taliban. But we'll have to see. We might get started for several months at least. Colonel David Lamb, thanks so much. Chief of Staff, former Chief of Staff, Combined Forces Command in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2005. Talking about next steps in Afghanistan. Thank you, Colonel.
You're welcome.
At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following. Todd?
President Obama, John, made an emotional pitch to try to get some public support for health care legislation. At a rally north of Philadelphia yesterday, he set up the insurance companies as the villains.
How much higher do premiums have to rise until we do something about it? How many more Americans have to lose their health insurance? How many more businesses have to drop coverage?
The president also took aim at Republicans for holding up reform, but Republican leader in the Senate Mitch McConnell says Americans want the reform plans scrapped. The president today hosts the prime minister of Greece at the White House. Greek officials say the U.S. cannot afford to ignore Greece's major financial problems, but the officials say they are not looking for a handout from Washington.
They are looking for Washington to regulate investors, though, who are shorting Greece and causing all kinds of problems over there. It's a really interesting story down there in Washington. Yeah. Some Toyota owners, Todd, say safety recalls have caused the value of their cars to plummet. They filed at least 80 class action suits that could cost the automaker more than $3 billion. That's according to the Associated Press. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, as the health care battle rages on, we'll tell you the story of one embattled congressman facing critics inside and outside his party. Do you know his name, Todd?
Oh, I do. I think that's Eric Massa, right?
Have you ever been to the showers in Congress? Do they let
you
in?
You asked me that on the air.
Do they let you in? No. Todd will be telling us more about former New York Congressman Eric Massa and the health care reform debate in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is certainly a talking point down in Washington, and it's a little story that begins, once upon a time, there was a Democratic congressman from Western New York named Eric Massa, who said he had some health problems and needed to leave his post as a member of Congress. Then he went on the radio and told a different story, saying that they, the White House, will stop at nothing to get health care reform passed, and now they got rid of me, and it will pass. You connect the dots. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, joins us. Is Eric Massa correct in saying he's a victim of some sort of vendetta in the White House because he voted against health care reform?
Well, he certainly wants people to think that he is. And this is all tangled up with a whole bunch of things, John. The first thing that caused Eric Massa from up around Corning, New York, in Western New York, to say he was not going to run for re-election was a cancer diagnosis. Fair enough. He doesn't want to run for re-election because he's sick. Then a couple of days later came the news that, in fact, he was under an ethics investigation by the House Ethics Committee for allegedly making a sexual pass at a male staffer. Then fast forward a couple of more days, Eric Massa goes on his own...
Let's listen. Here he really raises the stakes, shall we say, talking about Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff.
And I'm sitting there showering, naked as a jaybird, and here comes Rahm Emanuel, not even with a towel wrapped around his tush, poking his finger in my chest, yelling at me because I wasn't going to vote for the president's budget. Do you know how awkward it is to have a political argument with a naked man? It's ridiculous. But that's... So, by the way, what the heck is he doing in the congressional gym? He goes there to intimidate members of Congress.
So that statement, it's fair to say, grants Eric Massa a bit of a life after resignation, wouldn't you say?
And maybe that's the point. He's going on Glenn Beck at 5 o'clock today and on Larry King tonight in primetime, maybe to prove the point of how viable maybe he is as a post-disgraced political figure in the strain of Tom DeLay on Dancing with the Stars, or maybe Rod Blagojevich on, I don't know, I think he was on Donald Trump's show or something like
but
that.
But let's not forget Rahm Emanuel here. I mean, he does have a reputation. For intimidation. Is it possible that there's any truth to this?
Well, sure, it's possible. I mean, one thing in defense of Rahm Emanuel, if I may, as a former member of Congress, he does have congressional gym and, I guess, congressional gym shower privileges.
Yes,
and
access
he is
to
famed.
The showers. Thanks for that investigation there, Todd.
Right.
Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, has just responded to Eric Massa's charges about Rahm Emanuel. Listen to him talking on ABC News this morning.
I think this whole story is ridiculous. On Wednesday, was having a recurrence of cancer. On Thursday, he was guilty of using salty language. On Friday, we learned he's before the ethics committee to be investigated on charges of sexual harassment. Clearly, his actions appear to be in the appropriate venue in the ethics committee to look at.
Well, Glenn Beck is another venue. Is the White House sufficiently out in front of this, do you think, or is this going to live for a while?
Oh, they're a little bit behind it. I think it's going to live for a while as long as Eric Massa can keep sort of the phosphorescent blaze of media attention going. I don't want to ascribe motives to him. He seems very upset, but he's certainly getting plenty of attention. We should say that the House Democratic leadership, the office of Speaker Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, both say that his story is ridiculous. He tells another story that he is being forced out because he voted no on health care and no on climate change. As a Democrat, they're looking for every vote they can get on healthcare coming up. Obviously, one of his stories here is that he's being forced out to take one of the no votes off the board. So as long as he keeps making accusations like that, true or not, I think we're going to keep paying attention.
But it is true that they're counting every single vote there on
yes.
healthcare reform, even
yes.
now, even with the Democratic majority in the House.
Yeah, it is true. It's absolutely true. And whether they forced him out or not, Massa's departure does help the House leadership. They are going to be scrapping for every vote on health care. There are plenty of complications on that bill, John, on abortion and immigration and cost and everything else. And it's true that now the House leadership doesn't need 218. They need 216 to pass that bill because of vacancy. So whatever the motives are, it did help them a little bit.
And finally, does this have any implications for other legislation?
Well, it could have implications. Let's see. Well, climate change may be coming up and coming back to the House.
What about jobs?
The end of the year. Jobs. Oh, absolutely. There are going to be a lot of close votes on jobs. But climate change is probably a big one.
All right. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent. Stay with us, of course. For our last takeout, we call our listeners geniuses a lot on this program. But in the week of our week-long series exploring genius, what it is, who is one, what are the qualities and more, you can catch up on our site, thetakeaway.org. We thought we'd... turn the conversation over to your voices. We asked you, what is a genius?
Troy from North Dakota. By my definition, a genius is a visionary thinker. But the visionaries I've known have been big ego elitists whom nobody wanted to work with.
Sounds like some of the geniuses in Troy's life might be
kind
of jerks.
A bad genius experience, Troy.
He's having bad genius experiences, but not all of those geniuses take heart, Troy. Not all of them have to have the huge egos.
My name is David Young. I'm from Miami, Florida, and genius in my life is Dr. David Ellenson. He was one of my teachers at Hebrew Union College, but what really makes him a genius is that whenever he walks up to me and says hello, he not only remembers my name, and he teaches hundreds of people on a daily basis. He remembers my name, my wife's name, my children's names, and about how old each of them are. And that's really what makes him a true genius, is his caring for the person.
Now, there's another kind of genius, of course, John. Geniuses who can do those astonishing things just with the mundane activities of the everyday.
My name is Rose Carvajal. I want to say that my brother is definitely a genius. Since a little boy, he has done unbelievable things. Today, he's in his 60s, and this man can pick up anything, read it, and know it backwards and forwards.
You know, they say LBJ was a political genius because he remembered every name of every constituent he ever met.
So they say. That might be apocryphal.
It's closer to true than it is false, it seems to me. Gina in Miami posts to our site. People love to talk about this. Genius, she says, is actually the interaction between a person's soft assets, creativity, passions, and values, and their hard assets, skills, expertise, and strengths. What's your definition of genius? You can weigh in and catch up on our site, takeaway.org. While you're there, you can read an excerpt from David Shank's terrific book, The Genius in All of Us, and see audio examples of genius down through history. And David's going to be answering your questions on genius all week. Would you be a math genius? Would you be a genius in politics? What would you be if you were a genius? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up, the 10 most wanted list. They're not geniuses, but it's 65th anniversary.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for Celeste Headlee this morning, and I'm here with John. Coming up, the FBI's most wanted list turns 60 years old this month. We talk about how it's evolving for this decade.
You're not on it. I'm checking. You're not on it.
I was.
I'm still checking.
Done my time. Well, more on that in just a few moments. Here are some of the top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is visiting the Taliban heartland today. He's in Kandahar in Afghanistan, where it's a city of nearly a million people that's expected to be the target of the next big NATO offensive. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden is in Israel this morning, where he's once again calling for sanctions against Iran.
We're determined to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. And we're working with many countries around the world to convince Tehran to meet its international obligations and cease and desist.
Biden also said Israeli security would continue to be the cornerstone of relations between America and Israel.
The percentage of American workers with virtually no retirement savings is up for the third straight year. 47% have less than $10,000 in savings. And the number of American workers who have less than $1,000 in the bank jumped from 20 to 27%. Story from England. Dog owners may soon be required to take out insurance against the risk of their dogs attacking someone. The measure is in response to a growing problem of dogs being bred in the UK as weapons. Let's check the markets. Asian markets mixed. European indices down. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,552. The S&P at 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
In the last weeks of March 1931, Elliot Ness and his Untouchables were hitting hard at the Capone Empire. Every day, gunshots rattled the concrete as Ness led his men in raid after raid.
That makes you think of G-Men and J. Edgar Hoover and Tommy guns and gangsters and the FBI, right? Sorry for that, Edward G. Robinson's there. Well, the FBI's 10 most wanted list actually came into existence in 1950. It turned 60 years old this month. Now, on March 14th, 1950, Thomas Holden became the very first man to be put on the top 10 list. He earned the distinction as a noted bank robber and train robber who killed his wife and her two brothers. And a little over a year later, Holden was arrested when a man reported his whereabouts after seeing his picture on a most wanted poster. Well, most wanted posters are a thing of the past because now we've moved to iPhone apps and to social networking, believe it or not. FBI historian Dr. John Fox is here to tell us how the top 10 list, the most wanted list, has been working since that successful start some 60 years ago. Good morning, Dr. Fox.
Good morning.
Hi. So give us something on the numbers here. How many people have been on the FBI's most wanted list, and how many people have been captured?
Well, we've had over 490, I believe it's about 494 people on the list since it was started. And of those, 463 have either been captured or located. You know, sometimes someone's taken off the list because of court action or things like that.
So that's a hit rate. I'm not great at math like John Hockenberry is, but that's a hit rate of over 90%.
It is a very good hit rate, yes. And about a third of those have been because of citizen participation, which, of course, is the purpose of the list.
So with most wanted posters, you know, they're not on the post office wall anymore, as, you know, communities used to. The post office was the center of life, and they're not so much anymore. How is the top 10 list working now? Just television advertisements, billboards? How's the FBI getting the list out to people these days?
Really, through a wide range of media, from TV shows like America's Most Wanted to, of course, the internet, to digital billboards. We have a number of those digital billboards around the country that will post fugitive information
off the side of highways. You're talking about,
yes, sir.
You know, Dr. Fox, you know, that 90% success rate, it reminds me that J. Edgar Hoover was a fabulous self-promoter there in Washington, as you well know, down through history. Is it possible the 10 most wanted list is actually the 10 most nearly caught list?
Well, considering that some of these people have been on the list for a very long time, and certainly over history, the average rate is not a matter of days, but often a matter of months. No. Some of them have been captured even before we could get the publicity out. There's a small handful of them, but most of them, the publicity got out, and it was often a help. As I said, about a third of our captures have been because of citizen tips.
And John Fox, what is the longest amount of time a fugitive has spent on the 10 most wanted list?
I don't have that at the tip of my tongue, but it is, about 20 years.
Wow. Oh, yeah. 20 years on the run. Well, the whole idea of the FBI having the list is to keep fugitives from being on the run for 20 years. And I want to turn now to Ken Hoffman. He's the unit chief over the investigative publicity unit at the FBI. Mr. Hoffman, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the FBI, as I said earlier, is moving away from the post office poster and swerving into social media. Describe for me exactly the new 10 most wanted list. What does it look like?
Well, since about 1996, we've posted all of our information about the 10 most wanted on our website. That was done mostly to increase visibility, and it really takes our 10 most wanted list beyond the borders of the United States. It used to be if you wanted to know who was on the list, you had to stop at a post office. That's not the case anymore. You can just log right on onto our website. In addition to that, we've moved more into social media using tools like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube.
Well, Ken, I'm wondering, it is one of the first sort of calls for crowdsourcing, and it goes way back to the 90s, as you say. But I'm wondering if you want to enlarge it. I mean, if I had an app on my iPhone, I think I'd be much more interested in a, 10,000 most wanted list and be able to see who's moving where from time to time. And I'd be much more interested in that than just 10. Maybe you want to enlarge it, 1,000, maybe 100.
Well, on our website and through our other investigative publicity means, using social networking, we do provide information about other fugitives and missing persons and missing children and unknown victims. But the thing about the 10 Most Wanted program is it's very focused, and our purpose there is to focus people on the people that we think are the fugitives that we think are the biggest menace to society, the people with the longest records of criminal activity, and the people that we really think that the publicity is going to do some good to try to find them.
Now, Ken Hoffman, how many times to date have you nailed a fugitive and the tipster called in and said, "I saw him on Twitter"?
Well, I can't say we've had anyone yet. But
right.
I will say that we do have 33,000 followers on Twitter right
really?
Now.
Really? 33,000? More than I have.
That's only, we've only had Twitter running in the FBI here for probably the last 12 or 14 months.
Right. Well, you also have tie-ins with digital billboards and jumbotrons at ball games. So the idea is flash up a fugitive's picture down at the baseball game, and you might see him on the way home.
That's correct. We'll put him where we have the most set of eyes. I like to talk about one of our most successful billboard captures, and that's actually we had a mother who was driving down the highway and saw her son on a billboard, and she turned to her son in the passenger seat and said, "Why is your face up on that billboard?"
And he said,
"And he said
the dog ate my homework."
Right,
and mom.
And she pulled over and called the FBI. Well, that's crowdsourcing at its very finest, family sourcing. Ken Hoffman is unit chief over the investigative policy unit at the FBI, joining us to talk about the new look of the FBI's 10 most wanted list, John.
You can see a slideshow of some of the FBI's historic most wanted criminals, not including Todd Zwillick, at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk about work every Tuesday, but with more men being laid off than women and more women becoming the family breadwinner, how's this affecting the workplace and families around the nation? That's later this hour. And by the way, tomorrow and Thursday, I'll be in Miami, co-hosting from our member station, WLRN. It's expected to be 72 degrees in Miami today. All week, John, we're asking, not about the weather, what does Haiti need from the world right now? If you've been affected by the quake, and especially if you're Haitian, what are you not getting that you still need? It's sort of a way to, what are responsibilities, nation to nation, people to people, that have nothing to do with international borders or particular countries? Do we have responsibilities to people who are near us or in our neighborhood, in our region? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. So one of my favorite places in the universe is the Florida Everglades, where it is fair to say that almost anything in the biosphere will grow, will thrive, except for humans, unless you drain it. Tony Young, good morning.
Good morning.
You're the statewide hunting expert in Florida, media relations coordinator for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Good morning to you.
That is correct. Good morning.
Is it the case that you drop something into the Everglades, except for maybe a human being, and it's going to thrive?
Well, it's just, you know, that part of the United States is very subtropical. I mean, it's really probably the only subtropical area in the United States. So there is a lot of different things that can live down there that can't live in other parts of the United States on a year-long basis.
And lots of sun, lots of fresh water, and lots of vegetation. It's basically paradise for pythons, right?
Well, yes. It has been. They've become established down there, and we think we've kind of traced it back to Hurricane Andrew. When Hurricane Andrew hit back, Miami was, and it still is, has a large number of exotic pet dealers. And basically, we think when the hurricane came and destroyed some of these businesses, the pythons were able to get out of their cages, and they made their way west to the Everglades.
So now there are enough pythons in the Everglades to justify a hunting season, which is open now, right?
Yes, sir. It's actually, we have been allowing hunters to actually harvest pythons and other reptiles of concern actually since the beginning of hunting season in late August. So it's been going on all year, but right now there's a special reptile of concern season going on because nothing else is being hunted right now in these three management areas down in South Florida except for the Burmese python. So that did start yesterday, and it will go through April 17th.
And it is a huge problem. I mean, you know, we don't want to joke about killing animals for no reason, but the population of pythons puts a stress on other species, much like invasive fish species have caused problems down in the Everglades. What would you recommend hunting a Burmese python with? A bow, a gun, a net?
Well, we are allowing hunters to use any weapon that you would that you could use on a game animal, except for high-powered centerfire rifles. So you can't use the 30-30 or 30-06 or 270 or something like that. But basically, I would recommend a 12-gauge shotgun with buckshot.
Oh, now, you know, I'm going to get so many calls and emails and stuff about people worrying about the poor little snakes. Now, you mentioned harvesting the snakes. Do people actually eat python or do something with python other than put it in the landfill?
You can. I mean, you can eat python just like a lot of people eat rattlesnake, but. We did do some testing on some pythons earlier, I guess in the year, or I guess actually last year, and the testing revealed some pretty high levels of mercury content in the meat. So we're really not recommending anybody eat the meat.
Nevertheless, it's open season on Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades, a way of dealing with that population explosion of pythons from pet stores, possibly from Hurricane Andrew. Tony Young, statewide hunting expert in Florida and media relations coordinator for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, with some hunting suggestions there. Thanks, Tony. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick, sitting in for Celeste Headley. Coming up, a shift in the labor force. Mostly men have been affected in layoffs from this recession. What does it mean if the labor force is shifting gender-wise? And what does it mean in workplaces if employers have to deal with more female workers than male workers. Right now, we're going to check in on that in just a few moments. But first, a check on leading stories at 48 minutes, just 48 minutes after the hour. Todd?
Thanks, John. Top administration officials are on the road this morning. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in the city of Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. Kandahar is seen as the next major offensive for U.S. and NATO troops in the coming months. And in Israel, Vice President Joe Biden has accused Iran of destabilizing the Middle East by supporting terrorist groups. Back home now, President Obama made an impassioned plea for health care reform yesterday. Speaking to students near Philadelphia, he said insurance companies want to delay health care reform.
There's no secret they're telling their investors this. We are in the money. We are going to keep on making big profits, even though a lot of folks are going to be put under hardship.
Meanwhile, now Brazil has issued a list of 100 American products that will face heavy tariffs unless the U.S. agrees to stop paying subsidies to its cotton farmers. The sanctions, which will go into effect in 30 days, have been approved by the World Trade Organization. BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett joined us earlier to explain.
Well, this is a real trade war, because what the Brazilians are saying are, first of all, that they're going to put a huge tax or tariff on any cotton or cotton goods coming in from the United States into Brazil. You can understand why they might feel angry about that, because they are not happy with the subsidies given to the cotton farmers. But they're going much further than that. They're saying they will also put a tariff on things like cars, on even things like milk powder, and they're even saying that they might try to penalise the pharmaceutical or the music industries from the United States by breaking copyright and intellectual patent agreements on those things, which would mean that they're penalising as many different companies as they possibly can in an attempt to stop the American government subsidising U.S. cotton farmers.
Is this a bona fide trade war at this point, or something that'll blow over in a couple of weeks?
It's endorsed by the World Trade Organization, which acts as a sort of judge and policeman on these kind of international disputes, and it's very clearly on the side of Brazil. Now, what the Brazilians are saying is that this should have been resolved, and the Americans should have stopped these subsidies to the cotton farmers a long time ago. And the World Trade Organization says, OK, in that case, you have the right to escalate the dispute by bringing in all these other products. Now, what the Americans would really like is a new bill to pass through Congress in the United States saying no more subsidies to American cotton farmers. That's obviously very, very unlikely to happen, because the administration in the US is just too aware that the political implications of that and the unpopularity that it would cause with the farming communities, particularly in the south of the United States, is just not worth the price.
Oh, that was Duncan Bartlett from our partner, the BBC. He joined us earlier this morning.
One other story. Authorities say they've taken a suspect into custody following that triple shooting at Ohio State University. Police say the three people were shot in a maintenance building early this morning. Authorities say the victims were not students. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. But with weeks and weeks and weeks of recession and climbing job numbers under our belt, the work week is much more about a shift that's taking place in the United States. Since December 2007, we have lost 7 million jobs in our country. That's not an unfamiliar figure. But the majority of those who've lost those jobs have been men. At the same time, women have been returning to the workplace in higher numbers than their male counterparts. So more and more women have taken on the role of primary breadwinner for their families. It has an impact at home and an impact on the job. Joining us now is Ellen Galinsky, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
And Yolanda Gault-Cavaness is a longtime family and parenting journalist for iVillage and Redbook. She's also here. Good morning, Yolanda.
Hi, how are you?
Now, I'm great, and, you know, they've been calling this the man session, or I don't know what sort of clever term they've been using for quite a while, but with these kinds of numbers, Ellen Galinsky, let's just begin with you, there's some sociology going on here. Are we really seeing a shift that has an impact in the workplace and in homes?
Well, interestingly enough, the majority of the job loss in the beginning was among men, but now it's kind of evened out so that it's 41% of women who have lost jobs, if you take February, last February to this February,
right,
and up 59% of men. But these shifts actually were happening before the recession. We have been tracking the U.S. workforce with a national study that we do for three decades, and we have seen a real change in both women and men. We've seen that the attitudes about women and men, about the proper roles of taking care of the family and working, have shifted, where that for the first time women and men agree. We see that young women are just as ambitious as young men, and women with children are just as ambitious as children as women without children. And we also see that now women are bringing in 44% of family income, and that one in four women is earning more than her husband or her partner. And so there's a real shift going on, but it's been taking place before the recession.
And socially, those things are going to ripple for many years to come. Yolanda Galt, Cabinet, so let's talk a little bit about from the employer's perspective here. Are employers seeing young women coming into the workforce at this point as the men are sort of moving out in greater numbers? And are they enthusiastic about these ambitious young women hires?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that women, young women, have been coming into the workforce for a while now. And, I mean, I just wanted to say, even though, you know, we are talking about women being the primary breadwinners, I'm sure Ellen would agree, let's not get it twisted. You know, the wages that women earn are still lagging far behind the wages that men have earned.
So, well, but does that explain the enthusiasm in that employers are going, well, we can get these women for cheap?
Well, it certainly might. I don't think that's something that we can ignore. And I think, you know, when I talk to women around the country, working women, and it doesn't really matter if they have children or don't have children, but, you know, if they don't have children and they're thinking about having children, it certainly does affect them. You know, that's the whole child care situation. It's still, you know, it's a difficult road to toe.
Right. Ellen Galinsky, with so many two-income households, I'm imagining that there are a lot of women on the job who haven't lost their jobs, who have spouses or partners who have lost their jobs. Does that require changes on the part of employers in looking at the flexibility and the need for this suddenly single-income household to cope?
Well, there has been a real shift among employers around flexibility. It used to be seen as a perk, something that you would do under the table for a good employee, but you certainly didn't want a lot of people knowing about it, because who would be there if you need them to work, et cetera. In this recession, and we actually did a study, a nationally representative study of employers, we found that 81% of them, that's 4 in 5 of them, were maintaining the flexibility that they had as a result of the recession, and 13% were increasing it, and only 6% were cutting it back. And that represents the fact that employers are now seeing that they can help employees at the same time that they can help employers. Now, taking Yolanda's point, we looked at whether or not people, this flexibility was voluntary or not, or were they just furloughing people. And a little bit more than half of employees have choices about working more flexibly. We define flexibility as needing to work for the employer and the employee. So some of the flexibility that's happening is really to just manage. But I think employees, on the other hand, would rather have a job than no job. So
indeed. Well, Ellen Galinsky, of course, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute, speaking from New York. Yolanda, before we go, final question. Is it possible that with all the caveats you've mentioned, that this recession is really bringing on a degree of progressivity in the workplace and in gender relationships at home between men and women that we might not have seen otherwise?
I say a decade ago, you talk to women around the country, the theme song would have probably been the Rolling Stones, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." It's slowly improving. I think that when you talk to women now, they know that you have to negotiate with your employer, and they feel confident doing that. They need to go negotiate with their partners at home, and they need to let go of the perfection complex that many of them have. Myself, I tell myself every day, I am not Claire Huxtable. It works for me.
All right. Well, you and me, you don't have to come up with a negotiation song to replace that "I don't get no satisfaction." Yolanda Galt Cabanis, longtime family and parenting journalist whose work has appeared in iVillage and Redbook. Thanks so much, Todd.
You can listen back to that conversation or anything else in the show, get our podcast, or listen to segments on demand. That's all on the site, thetakeaway.org. And if you want to tell us the story of your home, we'd love to hear it. You can reach us at 8778-MYTAKE or post to that site, thetakeaway.org.
And we're looking for all you geniuses to tell us us what it is you would be a genius at if you were indeed a genius, and we think that you are because you listen to this program, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how to reach us. We're doing a genius series all this week in honor of the book The Genius in All of Us. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for Celeste Headley. It's The Takeaway.
Super genius.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.